Welcome back to PS Editor's Podcast. I'm Greg Bruno. The Western-led international order is in disarray, and perhaps no recent event illustrates this better than this year's chaotic G7 summit in Canada.
Tensions are escalating between Canada and the U.S. as a war of words begins. Very dishonest and weak are just two of the things Donald Trump had to say about Justin Trudeau on Twitter last night after the G7 summit ends in complete disarray.
In the end, the leaders of the world's most advanced economies couldn't even agree on boilerplate language about peace, prosperity, and whether they were committed to a rules-based international order. Perhaps we should have seen this coming. For years, groupings like the G7 and multilateral organizations like the International Monetary Fund have been criticized for failing to reflect the pace of global economic change. For example, while many emerging markets are outperforming Western economies, they remain largely sidelined in global governance institutions. For my guest today, that amounts to a dereliction of duty. Jim O'Neill is the former chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management and has just started his new job as chair of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, better known as Chatham House. He is most famous, perhaps, for coining the BRICS acronym in 2001. And with the leaders of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, now gathering in Johannesburg for their 10th summit, this seems like an ideal moment to talk about the consequences of the failure to reform global governance structures to reflect today's economic realities. Hi, Jim. Thanks for joining us today on PS Editor's Podcast.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're very excited and lots to cover, so let's jump right into the conversation if we could. Mm-hmm. You've long argued that if global economic governance is to be effective, its main institutional structures need to do a better job representing economic reality. How should global economic governance change, in your opinion? And might more representative groupings address monetary and macroeconomic issues in general? How might they do that? And in particular, future economic crises?
Well, I think in the breadth of your question, you've partially answered it already, in my view. I think as ironically, but beautifully and strangely and also not very pleasantly represented by the G7 meeting in Canada recently, we live in a pretty outmoded form of global governance. The G7 countries, which of course represent the historic, most important seven democratic economies of the world, became prominent in the 1980s, when that group of countries dominated the world economy. It's not been that way, and increasingly not been that way ever since the turn of the millennium, arguably since the mid-90s and the Asian crisis. So if we want to truly have globally representative governance, however difficult it is, somehow we need to have at the core of whatever the right current answer is, a system that can change and evolve through time, sometimes in the past I've thought of it almost as like an equivalent in sport, some kind of promotion and relegation. But part of the dilemma is whatever entity that gets set up in any point in time may become irrelevant 20 years after. And that goes to the conceptual problem we have, but the specific one, which I think is a much deeper dilemma than many Western democratic countries realize, is we still have a general state of global governance where it feels like historically important democracies are basically trying to dictate the right way to run the world to a group of other countries that are economically bigger currently and have been for many years, especially in the case of China, a lot more successful and therefore very skeptical about playing by the rules that they set. And somehow we need to urgently change it.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, one of the underlying themes of the G7 summit was membership or absence of membership.
Russia should be in this meeting. Why are we having a meeting without Russia being in the meeting?
You've written and have called for China and Indian membership. And that kind of goes to the point that you're making, that membership is not nimble enough to respond to the realities of the day.
I mean, I would say, I do think even though there are issues about accountability and size, I think the existence of the G20, which of course it had already been set up, but it really came to the fore by President Bush and then British Prime Minister Gordon Brown in the 2008 and 2009 crisis rescue mission. The G20 does, by and large, include most of the world's important economies, and importantly, some that are not democratic and some, and of course, many that are. And that is a lot more representative than what we have elsewhere, and in particular with the G7. But of course, the dilemma, going back to one of the phrases you used in answer to my last comment about nimbleness, the G20 has actually has more than 20 countries, and can be accused of not being small enough to deal quickly with issues that arise. But I do think, the G20 is a significant improvement in terms of at least a group that's representative of the modern world. But I've argued, as I did in that latest piece on this topic for Project Syndicate, that within the G20, we need some kind of new G5 or G7. And in that context, maybe it's not irrelevant for me to point out that the G7 itself only came out of sort of sympathy, I think, by Washington and maybe Paris and Bonn at the time. They sort of added on Italy and Canada in the very late 80s or mid to late 80s, when in fact the G5 was a dominant weapon of at least economic and financial governance. And of course, as we know, soon after the fall of the Soviet Union, it temporarily became the G8 with the inclusion of Russia, because we thought they were going to be a democracy. But I don't think it's a realistic way to try and run the world. Based on some numbers I've played around with, so far this decade, nearly half of the change in the global nominal value of dollar GDP has come just from China. And obviously, therefore, anything to do with global economics, you can't do anything without China. It matters so much, as I'm also fond of saying. China creates another Italy every 2 years. What is the point of Italy being in this dominant individual small group of global leadership?
I mean, interesting on China, it seems like, you've been talking about increasing the role for growth economies, your phrasing, emerging economies to many others, for some time. And what seems to be happening, though, is that some of these countries, in China in particular, but also Russia, may be getting a little bit impatient or at least going their own way. China is building institutions like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, while Russia has its Eurasian Economic Union, which to many are seen as alternatives to the Western-led order.
Well, if you think it in the context of what we've discussed so far, it's not really surprising, is it? If these guys feel they're not welcome at some kind of accepted global table of governance, but they've got their own global interests and they want to have their own voice, it's not very surprising that they try and set up their own. And an irony in terms of my views on this, I'm. As you know, we're just about to have the 10th meeting of the annual political gathering of the so-called BRICS countries leaders. And actually, that came out 10 years ago, in my view, for the same sort of reason. And why I say it's ironic, it's not really clear to me that, as of yet, that BRICS leaders meeting has really done a great deal other than highlighted the fact that you have these countries that want to meet on their own. And so you are getting all these different things slowly, or maybe not slowly, certainly including the ones you highlighted, appearing all over different parts of this complex geographic world. And yet at the same time, we have something that, from what I can see, in a truly global sense, is sort of redundant in the G7.
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's interesting. Let's stick with the BRICS for a moment. And BRICS, you're referring to the term you created back in 2001 to capture the growing economic importance of Brazil, Russia, India, China. And then in 2010, South Africa was added to form the BRICS acronym. Talk about your predictions 17 years ago now. You've already suggested that asset class is still relevant, that grouping of nations is still relevant. But what should we expect from the 10th summit, which is set to take place in South Africa this month, beyond more statements of cooperation?
It's a very good question. In the current mood I find myself, I'm trying to set them a challenge from anything I talk and write about it, and I'll do it with you. I think they should set themselves an exam question as they go into this 10th meeting. What have they achieved at all by meeting together? It's not clear to me, as a lot of South Africans get very upset hearing me say, it's not clear to me why South Africa's even in the club at all, other than the fact it's a reasonably, it's obviously a democratic African country with a vaguely developed form of governance a la Western standards. But, China creates another South Africa every 3 or 4 months. Certainly not representative of the rest of Africa. If you speak to any Nigerian person, particularly in policy, they get very irritated by the idea that South Africa supposedly represents their interests. So there's one issue, and I sometimes tease the BRICS leaders' advisors that ever since South Africa came into the club, that coincided with the peak of the BRICS collective economic performance, ironically. But in addition to that, the core exam question is, have anything they have done helped any of their individual growth performances or their collective economic, particular trade and investment performance? During the last six of the 10 years that they've met, three of the BRICS, including South Africa, themselves, Brazil and Russia, as everybody knows, have had a very challenging economic period. And the second decade of my acronym has not been as powerful for them individually as it was the first. Although I quickly add, of course, China continues to go along the path that I thought out. But the exam question for the BRICS leaders is, what is the point of meeting unless they can do something to help each other and their collective benefit? Because at the end of the day, isn't that the purpose of all these forms of global gatherings? One would imagine that they're supposed to be there for some real purpose rather than just symbolism.
Yeah, and certainly perhaps a good time to answer that exam question as we look at some of these other global governance structures that are not being as effective as they could be.
Yeah, completely.
So maybe it's time to create a new new acronym, and perhaps we should do it on the podcast today. maybe it's time for the next BRICS. If you could just talk a little bit about your next 11, and is it time to restructure the types of groupings that we place in growth economies that are important to global economic growth?
Let me just, before directly answering you, let me just talk a bit more about the BRICS. Whilst Brazil and Russia, of course, had a very difficult decade, it is the case 17 years on, because they all did so well in the first decade, that the relative and absolute position of the BRICS countries, with the exception of Russia, but including Brazil, is sort of where I envisaged it at the start of the last decade. Despite Brazil's problems, it's still one of the 10 largest economies of the world. It's bigger than Italy. There's another reason. If I was a Brazilian leader, I'd be thinking, well, why should we not be in this G7? Why are Italy in it? Yes, some of the BRICS issues and economic performance of some of them hasn't been particularly impressive this decade, but neither of those have other existing alliances, including much of the European Union. So it's important to remember that. And the other thing I'd like to say is, the ongoing economic performance of China from the long-term perspective of the BRICS thinking that I and my colleagues did is almost perfectly in line with what we envisaged. And yes, China has slowed down, and yes, China has issues, but the overall Chinese performance for people, the few people that think about its evolution in the way we did, it's going exactly as we expected. So anything that China really lends its weight to, which does include the BRICS Club still, and of course it includes the Asia Investment Infrastructure Bank, and it includes the New Development Bank and so on, these are very important things for the increasingly outward-looking China. So with all that in mind, let me now turn to the question you asked. Because I think it's relevant in the context of another issue to do with China, which is the so-called One Belt, One Road initiative. China is obviously front and center and of that, and one might even call it it's China's baby. And I say it in this context because many of the so-called next 11 emerging economies, which is literally a phrase I and my colleagues dreamt up for the next 11 largest populated countries after the BRICS, many of those next 11 countries are in the broader sort of circumference of One Belt, One Road. And I think at this moment in time, if China really wants that to be a true source of global success, and not as some as the cynics just often say, as a way of China helping to get rid of excess capacity in some of its old industries, I think it's important that some of these countries are not only excited about being a bigger part of that, but China should find a way of allowing some of these places to perhaps even design how One Belt and One Road should develop, whether it be the likes of Vietnam or the Philippines or Pakistan, or actually, crucially, one of the BRICS countries too, India. At a time where we have this very worrying threat of conventional ways of global trade from Donald Trump, if India and some of those other countries I just said were all excitingly proactive about One Belt, One Road, the impact potentially of all of that on certainly Asian trade, but global trade as well, would be so vast, we'd all be sitting around wondering what is the relevance of what Trump is talking about. And so there's lots of things these BRICS and other countries' leaders can do if they are determined to actually use these forums to be a force for common economic and social benefit.
I mean, let's stick with that leadership point for a moment, because it seems to me we have a couple of problems. We have the representation problem of membership that's reflective of economic reality, and we have a desire to be nimble, and countries like China and Russia that see some benefit to essentially going it alone. But in the global framework, for it to be truly effective again, leadership will need to be essential. And with the U.S. going in one direction, the United Kingdom going in largely the same inward-looking direction, the European Union divided, and China's stance somewhat ambiguous from a global perspective, who's going to take charge of this reforming?
So, you know, on one level, because it is 17 years since I thought of the whole BRICS concept, perhaps strangely, on one level, a lot of what you've just rather beautifully outlined isn't that surprising to me, because of course, as we started off by discussing, the old established way of running the world was a lot easier when it was just dominated economically by Western democracies. And so maybe we are in this sort of strange era of sort of a bit like a poker or chess game where we're trying to find out what is the right new structure. But with that conceptual comments in mind, I think that the IMF has a serious obligation, in my view, to try to come up with at least some proposed concept of how major institutions, themselves included, should adapt and evolve and be representative through their board and voting structure And with it, with the G5, G7, G20, and so on, as we grow through time. I sort of joked about it earlier, about some kind of concept of promotion, and a better phrase than relegation, but we sort of need to have that. I mean, because when you really stand away from it and look at it from 40,000 feet, you know, China and India, to take the two most populated ones, are obviously both countries of more than a billion people. And given that long-term economic growth is basically driven by working age demographics and productivity, it is sort of common sense that at some stage in the future, these two countries will be, you know, if not the absolute biggest, close to being the biggest in the world. And that's what our BRICS thing showed. And it looks like we're on that path. And so why should it be such a big deal for everybody else to worry and complain about it? I mean, you know, the United States has been the biggest and most dominant economy in the world for, what is it, 50 odd years, if not longer. And that's the way it's become accepted. But, you know, the UK was that in the last century, in the century before last. And, you know, we've sort of vaguely, maybe Brexit questions what I'm about to say, but we've sort of gracefully accepted our relative decline. And importantly, as a nation and with our citizens, benefited individually and collectively with higher wealth with the emergence of all these other places. And, you know, that's just seems to me normal and natural. And we need to have some kind of global governance that doesn't get so sensitive from a national perspective to the rise and fall of various nations. And I think the IMF is the only institution I can think of that has some real obligation to at least suggest the right kind of criteria to deal with this as we go through time.
Yeah, I think that's where I was going to wrap this back. You know, starting at the, we started our conversation with a look at the G7 and the chaos and the inability to even agree on platitudes about staying united and building a world united in peace and prosperity. We couldn't even sign that. So who's going to decide the promotion and demotion of countries is a much bigger question and a far more complicated one. But it sounds like your view is that the IMF is the only institution with any sort of credibility to handle that huge task.
I think it probably is. And I share the views of a number of international thinkers that I've discussed these kind of issues with over the years. The last thing we want is, you know, the creation of yet another institution just to do, promote and preside over this. And when you've got something like the IMF, which itself has to evolve. I have to say, as a bit of a plug, as you may know, I am within a week or so of becoming the new chair of Chatham House. And I think there's an important role for think tanks like Chatham House to come up with much more detailed and credible solutions to these kind of major challenges of our era, which are likely to be at least as challenging, if not more, as we go through the next decade and beyond. But I don't think these are insurmountable dilemmas. It just requires people to be open-minded and to get out of their comfort zones.
Well, we will certainly be looking forward to seeing what you and Chatham House come up with. And until then, thank you very much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you for having me do it.
That was Jim O'Neill, a former chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, former commercial secretary to the UK Treasury, and chair of the Chatham House International Affairs Think Tank. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Until next time, I'm Greg Bruno.